This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, we'll hear about a journey west during the gold rush that ended on the Central Coast.
There were so many wagons going across using the same routes that ruts formed that everyone could follow.
Also, architectural historians and architects discuss hopes for the future of affordable housing.
A very, very important aspect of the social housing in both Austria and the Netherlands is that it remains under the control of the government and it never goes back into the market.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, September 9th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Extreme heat can be life-threatening for many Californians, especially those without air conditioning in their homes. While it's a requirement for landlords to provide heat during the colder winter months, there's no such requirement when it comes to dealing with hot weather.
The hot weather will continue across much of the state today. Many landlord groups have pushed back against this type of requirement. But a poll last year from the UC Berkeley Institute of Governmental Studies found that two-thirds of Californians support the idea of the state establishing cooling standards for residential properties. KVPR's Joshua Yeager spoke to residents in the Central Valley who are just hoping for some relief.
The dual whirr of fan blades fills every room inside Mario Garcia's house in Lamont, a tiny agricultural community outside Bakersfield. Box fans, ceiling fans, standing fans. Whatever the 53-year-old can use to get relief from a brutal heat wave that'll send their mercury skyrocketing above 105 degrees outside.
Ooh, really hot, really hot.
He worries for his children, all six of them, who share the three-bedroom house. That includes 17-year-old Crystal Garcia, who says heat makes it hard to keep up with their studies.
It's very hard to concentrate, especially if we were to have summer school.
She uses an ice pack to cool off.
I would like put it in my bag or put it in my stomach, and it just like relaxes me. It makes me forget about the heat.
Garcia's home is like many in the rural San Joaquin Valley. It uses a swamp cooler rather than central AC to battle the heat. But these systems, which rely on water to cool, are typically little match for triple-digit temperatures.
It's cooler outside under a tree than inside the house.
State insurance officials say heat waves have killed more than 400 Californians in the last decade and sent 10,000 more to the hospital. Especially at risk are those without air conditioning. That includes nearly a third of renters, according to researchers at UCLA. Protections for California renters are slim. State law requires landlords to provide heat in the winter months, but no equivalent law exists for cooling. And that's a far more pressing problem for inland California. Sandra Placencia is with the Leadership Council for Justice and Accountability, a local nonprofit that is pushing for indoor maximum heat thresholds.
We stress that this is necessary because we have a lot of residents that are farm workers. They go out, they're out in the hot sun all day, right? And they come home to a house that's also very hot, right? So during the summertime, they really have no cooling.
A recent draft report from the state recommends a threshold of 82 degrees. But the recommendation is just that, with no legal power. It would also only cover new construction and is likely to face major pushback from landlord groups. And even if protections are passed, many renters can't afford to run their air conditioners.
PG&E bills during this time are incredibly expensive.
The city of Bakersfield offers subsidies for utility payments and weatherization upgrades. Advocates say it's a good first step, but it's underfunded. And local efforts to establish maximum heat thresholds have failed to take off, according to Andre Gonzalez, Bakersfield's vice mayor.
It hasn't been a discussion on the city council dais just yet. Definitely something we need to explore and look at so that we can meet the goal that we're all seeking, and that is to ensure that lots of folks have the cooling systems that they desperately need.
And the need was urgent for Jamie Seeger, a senior who lives in a Bakersfield apartment. Her AC recently broke down. Her unit was eventually repaired, but the whole process took longer than she hoped.
You want to be reasonable about these things. But something like this, air conditioning, that is literally life and death. The law falls short, and that needs to be changed.
Bakersfield broke a record this July when temperatures exceeded 105 degrees for 11 consecutive days. Human-caused climate change is likely to accelerate the trend. In the meantime, absent human solutions, thousands of renters in the valley will struggle to stay cool, sometimes with deadly results. I'm Joshua Yeager in Bakersfield.
New rules aim to keep high school athletes safe during hot weather. California schools must now adjust sports practices and games when it's too hot outside. The state law went into effect over the summer.
Mike West leads the California Interscholastic Federation's Southern Region, which includes LA.
The goal is that we don't have any more fatalities due to what is an entirely 100% preventable issue, which is heat stress and heat-related illness.
LAist Mariana Dale checked in with a local high school to better understand how the rules work.
Schools must now monitor the weather with a wet bulb globe thermometer. The device better predicts the impact of heat on the human body because it measures not only air temperature, but also humidity, wind, and sun. St. Francis head athletic trainer Eli Halleck checks the conditions at the La Cañada High School on a recent sunny afternoon.
We are at 80.2 on the wet bulb globe thermometer. We're at 86 degrees outdoors.
At this temperature, LA schools have to offer athletes longer water breaks than if it were cooler.
We want to keep them hydrated because that's going to reduce the risk of muscle tears, strains, sprains, and potentially heat exhaustion and moving into heat stroke.
The new rules also require games and practices to be moved or canceled once the temperature hits a certain threshold based on geography. For example, a school on the coast will have a different maximum temperature than one further inland. I'm Mariana Dale in Los Angeles.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, KCBX's Brian Reynolds speaks with author Diana Jackson about her new book. She traces her great-grandfather's journey across the United States to California's Central Coast in the mid-1800s. It's the history of the Dressler family of Paso Robles. The family owned the 3,000-acre Dressler Ranch from the late 1800s until the 70s. Jackson learned some surprising facts as well about the many people who took that long, harsh journey west.
Hello, I'm Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Diana Jackson, author of a new family memoir entitled From Bellewaet to Clark Gable in Three Generations, a family memoir. Welcome, Diana.
Thank you very much.
Now, you are a local person, and you live in Portland now, Portland, Oregon. So you'll be coming down here in a few days for a book signing and an event. And I want to mention that to everyone that that event is on September 13th in the afternoon, 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Dresser Winery. There will be wine and snacks and book signings, and the Dresser Winery is located at 5530 Dresser Ranch Place in Paso Robles. So put that on your calendar. It should be an exciting event. If you enjoy the book and local history, you're going to want to be there. So Portland's a long way from Atascadero, where you originally came from. Tell us about that journey, please.
I was born in Atascadero, and I lived in Paso Robles most of my young years. I went to Paso Robles High and graduated, and then off to the Bay Area, worked professionally in the Bay Area for many years. And after retirement, we ended up in Portland because we decided that we're getting older and we needed to be near kids. So here we are.
Well, certainly a beautiful spot. The entire Northwest, if it's not burning up in a wildfire, is a great place to live and be. I used to know it well when we lived in Northern California. Well, this is a very important type of interview for me because as a former librarian, I very much believe in local history and in people becoming familiar with that. These days, it's not such an easy thing to do. In fact, one of my big concerns, the raw material for those histories comes from physical artifacts. such as diaries, newspaper articles, census data, and so forth. And most of that stuff these days, almost all of it, is online. And so one wonders, what is going to be the raw material for the history going forward, which, completing the circle, I think, makes a book of this type so much more important, above and beyond the details, but representing rather a testimonial, I think, to the importance of local history, and with local people becoming aware of it. Not so easy to do. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
The Dresser family, they got started in Wisconsin.
Yes. My great-great-grandparents lived in Beloit, Wisconsin, and my great-great-grandfather decided that he wanted to be part of the gold rush that was happening in California. So he joined a company, or the company joined him, and they traversed the plains in 1850. And while doing that, he wrote letters to my great-great-grandmother, who had stayed back in Wisconsin to take care of their children. And she also wrote back to him. And I got a hold of those letters because someone in the Dresser family had bequeathed them to the library in Berkeley, the Bancroft Library. So I went up there and I got copies. And that was the genesis of this book, because it was so interesting to me. I thought maybe it would be interesting to other people.
So you found out about the existence of the letters. You went up to the Bancroft. And for those of you who don't know, UC Berkeley has a number of world-famous libraries. Bancroft is primarily the historical library there, especially California West Coast history. But you learned about these letters and you went up there and you read them.
Yes. Well, I couldn't read them all there that day because there were a lot of them. And they were actually the original letters. And what the library does is they take these kind of old letters, and in order to preserve them, they type out the content of the letters.
Right. Transcribe
it. Yeah, they transcribe it. And I got copies of both the originals and the transcribed letters. And they ended up Xeroxing them, and I bought them that way.
Now, I assume that the answer to this question is understood already, but did Sarah, your great-great-grandmother, did she save these letters, and then ultimately they went into the hands of descendants and ultimately to the Bancroft? Is that how it worked?
Presumably. Short on details in that regard, but they were preserved, and they were given to the Bancroft.
So having read the book and being fascinated by it, of course, it's a testimonial to so many things, American, the adventuring spirit, looking for new frontiers, literally and figuratively, to discover. But what struck me so much, and you allude to it in the book a little bit, is William Henry got to go off exploring, and Sarah got to stay home with the kids. I can't imagine. Well, that probably both of those jobs, if you want to call it that, were difficult. But she must have been a heck of a woman to acquiesce to that, to stay home and keep the farm, whatever, and the kids. And it's just give him permission to do that. And he was gone for several years, correct?
Yes, he was gone for 3 years. And while he was gone, she had another child, unbeknownst to him. She was actually pregnant with their fifth child when he left, and she did not tell him.
Really? I wonder why.
Yes.
Maybe.
Well, I think she decided that it was really something he wanted to do, and she didn't want to stand in the way of it. Hmm. But she herself was too afraid to go across the plains and decided to stay back east.
You mentioned earlier that William Henry Dresser, they would join a company. A company was like, I guess, a temporary gathering of people who were going to travel together and help each other along the trail.
Yes.
Do you have anything that you could read to us from one of those letters that might give a flavor of what it was like to cross the United States in 1850?
In 1850, about 44,000 people crossed the country from the east to California. And if you consider how many people that is, all with wagons and horses and oxen and so on and so forth, they got together, they grouped into companies, and they pooled the resources, and they went off with their covered wagons. And what was amazing to me, and I think it will may not surprise the reader, but it surprised me how many people were on those trails during that time. You know, my conception was from watching cowboy movies when I was a kid is, you know, you'd have a circle of wagons and that would be it. No, there could be 1,000 wagons pass a place during a day. It was an amazing feat. So as an example, Mr. James D. Persinger reported that their company passed 200 wagons during one 1850 morning, were passed by another 100 afternoon, and passed at least 500 another day. The number of people, of course, in each wagon varied, but that's an illustration that was caught my eye in my research. I read a lot of books on the gold rush.
You have to wonder, getting into a trek like that, what they were escaping from and what they expected to escape to. Certainly, there was the lure of financial success, you know, maybe making it in the gold fields or buying cheap land in California and so forth. But to me, that's pretty risky business to throw all of your dice or put everything in there on the gamble that you could get across safely and be glad you did. And I know also, having read the book, that they would have passed by the debris and the evidence of failed adventures from many other people, broken down wagons, dead livestock, maybe even some graves along the road. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. There were a lot of graves. A lot of people died. Cholera was a huge problem amongst the people traipsing across the prairies because they didn't know what caused it. And if they drank bad water, they were probably going to get cholera and die. There was a lot of death on the trails. It was not a safe journey by any matter of speaking.
And it took a while, like a couple of months, maybe, I'm guessing.
Yeah. The average progress in a day was about 24 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So if you calculate that out, it took quite a long time to get there. And that was just an average. Many days they didn't go nearly as far, depending on weather. That kind of thing.
I'd like to remind everybody, I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by author Diana Jackson, discussing her new book, a family memoir, From Beloit to Clark Gable in Three Generations of Family Memoir, about the Dresser family and their journey's beginning in South State, Wisconsin, but winding up in the Paso Robles area and owning thousands of acres of land. There is a author event planned for September 13th at the Dresser Winery, 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. with wine, snacks, and book signings. And that winery is located at 5530 Dresser Ranch Place in Paso Robles. What were some of the other things that maybe surprised you or caught your attention in the book as you were putting it together, things you didn't expect?
The Native Americans were extremely helpful to the immigrants early on. They really were, in most cases, not to be feared. They helped the immigrants, and they helped them by showing them the way, giving them directions, leading them in some cases over a mountain pass that might be difficult to go over. They traded. They were used to trading with Europeans early on, with the trade with the Canadians, for example, for the beaver skins and furs. And there was a helpfulness about them that I didn't expect based on everything that I had ever heard and the few books that I had read on the subject. So that surprised me a great deal. And in fact, in one of his letters, William Henry writes about his impression. He wrote to his sons, and not his daughters, but about dealing with the Indians and how good they were to them. And I don't really want to read out of that letter, because in today's society, there are words and phrases that aren't considered appropriate, but this was of the age and the time when these letters were written, so they don't show those sensitivities.
Right. It's one of the things, one of the problems I have as a person, a human being, as a librarian with the whole woke or anti-woke controversy is, well, in just simple terms, if you're not woke, you're asleep. If you're not awake, you're asleep. And I'd much rather be awake and functioning and informed than in some kind of a doze. But part of the narrative in America, which is that the land was stolen, literally stolen, by European settlers from the people who lived there, and in many cases, those at the very very best, those Native Americans, original Americans, if you will, were displaced. At the very worst, they were killed on the spot. It's just a tragic situation, and to me, we can't go back. No, it's impossible to change the past, but you certainly can learn from the past and understand that certain practices, certain behaviors, certain ways of speaking about others. Are just not only passé, but evil.
Yes.
I can't blame the settlers. They were here and they wanted to have a decent life too, but I have to blame the higher-ups for making some of the decisions and taking some of the actions that they did. Another element, I think a hugely interesting element of the book, is your husband Ray's road trips to follow some of the paths, including, and I think this is, even I've heard about this, but I've never really seen pictures or anything, but the actual wagon ruts from that era. Tell me about that, please.
One of the things that I had never done is taken the trip that he took. And someone suggested when I was starting my work on this book that since I have a blog, which is, by the way, travelswiththerayman.com, I had been blogging for years, and they suggested, well, why don't you take the same trip and write like you do in your blogs about your experiences? And so that became part of the book, and I thought it was a great idea, and it was a wonderful trip. And when you say the ruts, yes, there were so many wagons going across using the same routes that ruts formed that everyone could follow. And there's an organization in my research that I discovered, the Oregon California Trail Association, and they make a point of preserving ruts. So we had some information about these ruts, and so we went looking for them, and we found some. And it was quite thrilling to think that, gee, maybe I'm actually standing on the land that my great-great-grandfather stood on during his trip.
Wonderful. There will be an author signing at the Dresser Winery September 13th, 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. Wine snacks, and again, book signing. It'll be located at 5530 Dresser Ranch Place in Paso Robles. And before we actually sign off, I would like to tease people with a mystery. And the mystery is that one of your relatives was involved in the movie industry and knew some of the big stars, and that's reflected in the title of the book. There's a connection with your family and the great actor Clark Gable. I would like to remind everyone that I am Brian Reynolds for KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by author Diana Jackson to discuss her new book, a family memoir, From Beloit to Clark Gable in Three Generations, a Family Memoir. Thank you so much, Diana.
Thank you.
This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, architectural historians and New York City architects discuss social equity, architecture, and hope for the future of affordable housing. This is detailed in a new book, Housing the Nation.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the studios at KCBX NPR affiliate in San Luis Obispo, California. Come along and join me for a conversation with two seminal architects and architectural historian. Victoria, go ahead and introduce yourself and Quincy.
My name is Victoria Newhouse. I'm an architectural historian, and I'm a co-editor of the book that we're going to be discussing today, Housing the Nation.
And this is Quincy Williams, managing project architect at Alexander Gorling Architects here in NYC, representing Alexander Gorling at this discussion.
We're here today to talk about a new book, Housing the Nation, Social Equity, Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. Victoria, start out, talk to us a little bit about backstory, how the book came to be, and what you hope to communicate.
Well, Alex Gorling, who is the co-editor of the book with me, and I were invited to write an article for Oculus Magazine, which is a publication for architectural professionals, on affordable housing. This is 3 years ago. The issue had already begun to be talked about extensively in the popular press. We wrote the article, and after some research and thought about the subject, it occurred to us that a book on the subject, which would expand on some of the issues that we discussed in the article, could perhaps reach people, well, the general public for general information, but also people who we hoped might make a difference and help improve this very critical situation.
I think this book could serve as a handbook for anybody involved in the professional housing world.
That's what we had hoped for.
And additionally, what a great textbook for a postgraduate program, because you guys came up with an encyclopedic coverage of the subject.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, because we had hoped to broaden the general perception of the subject. We felt that most people knew very little, if anything, about it. And so that was actually one of our goals.
Well, you did a great job, home run. I've read the book 3 times, and I'm still trying to just digest the basics. It is so packed with information and history. For example, I would love to have you go back in time, because to understand today, you have to understand the roots of public housing. Talk for a moment about back 100 years ago, tenements in New York City and failed public housing projects in Chicago, etc.
Good. Well, I hope that Quincy will help me fill in some of the facts. Actually, public housing started seriously in the United States in 1937 as part of the New Deal. It was made possible by limited equity and co-ops, and it was segregated, as it remained so for decades, and in fact still is in many places.
Reading your book, one of the causes of the failure of public housing and housing projects was the absence of adequate funding for maintenance and security, etc.
Yes, well, NYCHA, which is the organization who is in control of public housing in New York City, has billions of dollars of debt in deferred maintenance. It has been a tremendous problem. And in fact, that group came to the realization a couple of years ago that they simply could not cover maintenance. They couldn't build and take care of maintenance. And they started then. I really haven't checked this, but it's my understanding. We were told a couple of years ago that they were starting to hire private maintenance corporations to make sure that what they built would hold up and be taken care of.
In fact, so through the RAD renovation process, NYCHA began pooling a series of for-profit developers to assist them in renovating their large dilapidated infrastructures. And it seems to be to the success of the city that this is seemingly working aside of the federal blockades that they've had in funding over the years for maintenance of their housing stock.
Interesting. This may be neither here nor there, but I was fascinated by a section where you talked about NYCHA and Alexander's plans for Chavez Ravine in Los Angeles in late 50s and how that was ultimately sabotage, even though it was a grand vision.
Yes, well, that is one of the more embarrassing or regretful incidents in the history of public housing, where the local government came up with a very, very nice plan for this particular area of Los Angeles, which was populated primarily by Mexican immigrants. Not luxurious housing by any means, but it was comfortable and it worked for the people who lived there. And the mayor at that time felt that it could be improved and also expanded. However, a gentleman who is quite famous, who owned the Los Angeles Times, Norman Chandler, was violently opposed to that. He was he was a conservative. He was against unions. He was against social welfare, including affordable housing. And he just put a damper on the whole thing. I mean, he managed with his rich and powerful friends to just shut the whole idea down, and it never got built.
In the early days of the Chavez Ravine Project, they came in and bulldozed minority, low-income housing, and that's something we've seen across the country, especially during 60s and 70s, quote, urban renewal. I spent time recently in Tulsa's Greenwood District, and they were showing me how the interstate blasted right through the heart of the neighborhood. I was in Cincinnati a few weeks ago, and they were showing me how the West End minority neighborhood was decimated by urban renewal, bringing in the interstate right through the center of the neighborhood.
Yes, well, that's happened in many cities. I'm not familiar with what happened in those particular cities, but I am familiar with Austin because I wrote recently about a new park there. And there, the connection between the downtown, the very, very prosperous downtown, and the much poorer east side of the city was completely destroyed by a federal highway, I-35, which came through in the 1960s.
Let's talk about, you had alluded to systemic racism as a barrier to affordable housing.
Yes, it is. And there are several objects in the book on the subject. One of our contributors, David Trout, is an African American. He teaches law. He's a lawyer. He teaches law at Rutgers. He has described in the book in great detail of what's happening in Newark, New Jersey, how big time development groups come in and buy up housing at very, very low rates from people in the African American community, and then just simply hitch up the prices for the same real estate.
Interesting. And that being said, you talk about the unaffordability of home ownership due to the exponential rise in property values, compounded by minimum wage not keeping pace. That's a huge deal breaker.
Yes, it is. Well, we have several economists in the book. I think they all agree that there is just too much of a difference in between the haves and the have-not in the United States today, probably in other countries too, but we're certainly very much aware of it here.
And you noted, a couple of your economists noted, that a fair minimum wage today would be between $23 and $26 per hour.
That's right, yes.
You know, the other thing that your book made me think about is you talk about a barrier to entry for any project is the exorbitant cost of land. And I spent some time a while ago in Hong Kong, and I went over to the New Territories. And they had just built a new, like, 30-plus story tall high-rise apartment building. And they had within it a shopping center, grocery store, medical care, and everything. And I thought, you know, what a brilliant solution to land use. Talk about that as an alternative.
Well, neither Quincy or I were familiar with that Hong Kong project, but it sounds like a great idea. Kimmelman wrote recently in the New York Times about another interesting idea, which is to combine the construction of affordable housing with the design and construction of a public library. I mean, people always want a library in their neighborhood. They don't always want affordable housing. So isn't it an interesting idea to put the two together?
Right. And in fact, so part of NYCHA's earlier mandate was to infuse affordable housing with different community services, whether it's daycares or some form of medical service on facility, taking from the mold that was developed in Europe in the early 20s. But I believe those quickly got phased out, and seemingly so in this time, it seems some of these facilities are slowly making their way back into the affordable housing sector as we start to develop modern affordable housing.
You noted a housing project for homeless in Los Angeles, an apartment complex that was very forward-thinking, and it, reading in the book, it sounds like a very successful project.
Some of the projects Quincy has worked on, in fact, include a number of services. Do you want to talk about that, Quincy?
So over the last few years, we've developed some projects, for instance, here in New York City for communal life, in which not only did we develop housing, but we developed community services around community art galleries so that neighborhood residents can have a destination, can have an outlet. What we've been finding over the past couple of years, whether with, for instance, art galleries or the infusion of an ambulatory diagnostic center within our residential buildings or some sort of community service, is that it helps the local community, but it also helps the residents to have these facilities on site. For instance, I mentioned just a few moments ago about a daycare center. These used to be things of old, and what we've been finding now is as HPD are bringing on new RFPs for housing in varying neighborhoods, as part of the community visioning report, the residents of the local communities are asking for some of these facilities to be embedded within the residential complex. And I think it bears importance. For one, childcare. We've seen through the pandemic that we had very large issues with childcare. And if we can have those within the residents, I think it helps that sector of our population.
Going forward, creating a holistic community where all your basic needs are there might hopefully eliminate the need for having a car or even public transportation, a walkable village.
We totally agree with that. These, again, coming back to these ideas of walkable communities, the convenience of that, and rightfully so, the environmental impact that that will have is tremendous. As you know, we talk about climate change. The car has been one of those vehicles, and the emissions, one of those vehicles that has fueled the climate issues that we have of today. Well, rightfully said, coming back to these communities, whether it's on a residential complex within a larger residential construct, I think will help multiple facets of our society.
Going back in time, you alluded earlier to 100 years ago. In your book, you talk about community housing dating from the 1920s in Vienna, Austria, that was very successful. Then you also note social housing in the Netherlands. It appears that they have been more evolved than us for decades.
Well, the big difference is, of course, that in those countries, the federal government subsidizes affordable housing. They started early. And so they've built up a whole system that still is very functional.
Very fascinating.
And I guess to add to that also is, rightfully said, as Victoria's mentioned, the government has played a key role in housing, let's say housing the nation, for lack of better words. But the housing, even though it's been kept to this day, it is not just for the unfortunate sector of society. It serves multifacets of society, young professionals, students, those who are impoverished as well. So it creates these very vibrant mixed communities. And that, I think, in terms of its mold, has been very successful in keeping it that way. In addition to that, there's another point that comes out in it also, by keeping these rents at a certain level and keeping this government social institution, it has also helped to create competition in the public sector. So public sector rents
don't seem to be egregious in comparison to what we see here in our sectors.
Yeah, I'd like to actually add one detail there to what Quincy just said, which is that a very, very important aspect of the social housing in both Austria and the Netherlands is that it remains under the control of the government, and it never goes back into the market.
Could that happen here?
I don't know. What do you think, Quincy?
I think it's a possibility. I mean, we've had, based on legislation, issues with such. I think coming out of the 1970s, in which the Section 8 vouchers, when government was shifting from Section 236 into Section 8 and so on, they allowed for certain subsidies to go into the sector. But then at some point, after a period of 15 years or after a period of the mortgage, the units could then turn themselves back over into the private sector. And I think that really hurts us. You know, if our intention really is to focus on the needs of our people and really help our society, then we should look at the mold of Vienna and the Netherlands and keep the units for perpetuity within the public sector.
You know, that being said, you make me think of SROs, single room occupancies, which, for example, out in the West Coast here, San Francisco and Los Angeles has had for 100 years. I was with the Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Skid Row in Los Angeles, and we looked up at this cool old high-rise, and it was an SRO. And he goes, well, somebody's buying it. They're converting it to upscale suites. And that's one of our problems, is that we have some of this housing, which we then destroy and take out.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a problem indeed. And, you know, I think stemming from the age in which we were rebuilding and or we were building our nation, these SROs provided for housing for the workforce. And it would be a great thing to preserve as much of those, because, for instance, our large unhoused young student population needs places to stay, and their families, whether it's a single adult or a young family, a young couple, could well benefit from an SRO unit. And I tend to believe most of those should have been preserved wherever we could.
And going forward, doesn't it make logical sense that we ought to put an emphasis on creating new SROs?
That is in conversation, I believe.
Let's talk about co-living and Section 8 housing for a moment.
I think, Quincy, you know more about that than I do.
Section 8, I think, for all its pluses and minuses, has an enormous benefit if we take a step back, in which vouchers were giving out so that affordable housing could be built. And I think this comes back to your prior question in terms of keeping housing affordable for perpetuity, very similar to the Vienna or the Netherlands model. And I believe Robert Kuntner speaks in depth about this in his essay, as well as Marjorie Perlmutter, I think, and Rosen Haggerty. Section 8 being what it is, I think, has become a problem in the current state as it is. For instance, there are a lot of Section 8 vouchers that remain unfulfilled in the nation as of today, and probably will be remained unfilled for families to hold these vouchers.
What's the barrier?
I think the barrier simply is in the private sector, landlords not wanting to deal with Section 8 as it is, because these tenants, potential tenants, they go out into the private market looking for residents. And I think in this day and age, where there is enough capital going around and there's a sector of a society that can rent for upwards of $4,000 a month for a studio apartment here in the city, as a landlord, why get into the hassle of renting with someone with a Section 8 voucher?
Interesting.
I believe that, you know, government should get involved in building affordable housing, building housing for those who are unhoused and who need them. And hopefully in doing so, we can and keep a housing stock. We can hopefully move residents from temporary housing into permanent housing in some designed fashion. But I think it's a long conversation.
Quincy and Victoria, to learn more about your world.
I guess we would say housing the nation, social equity architecture, and the future of affordable housing. Do find this in the bookstores at the Rizzoli bookstore as well as throughout the nation. And for the work that we do in terms of our office, do find us at alexandergorlinarchitects.com.
And Quincy, do you have a LinkedIn or website or go-to?
alexandergorlinarchitects.com. You can find us there. I am on LinkedIn as well as Alex and Victoria.
And Victoria, to learn more about your world.
Well, this is my 7th book, so anybody who's interested in what I've done before, I've written mostly about cultural institutions. Recently about repurposing land that has been used industrially, repurposing it for cultural events. And so anybody interested in that can Google me and you'll see all my books listed.
That's the one about parks around the world, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I love that
book.
Oh,
thank you. I think you interviewed me about it, actually.
I did. We did by phone.
Yes, right.
Saved us 3,000-mile trip. Well, Victoria and Quincy, thank you guys so very much. This has been fascinating.
Thank you, Tom, for your interest.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the West Coast from the studios at KCBX NPR affiliate in San Luis Obispo, California.
You can hear more of their conversation on our website, kcbx.org, under Journeys of Discovery. You're listening to KCBX Public Radio, and this is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, an oil spill in 2015 devastated the Santa Barbara community and its ecosystem. Now, Sable Oil Company is trying to restart operations. Despite high environmental risk, the Pacific Pipeline Company has gotten the okay from the county for a major step toward resuming operations. Here's student reporter Rosie Boltman from KCSB-FM radio station on the UC Santa Barbara campus.
Sable Offshore Oil Company has made strides in its effort to restart its oil pipeline running along the Gaviota coast. The pipeline has been shut down since the Refugio oil spill in 2015, one of the worst oil spills in California history. If the oil giant gets necessary approval from the state, it plans to restart the pipeline before the end of 2024. After legal battles with the county and concessions on both ends, the Pacific Pipeline Company, owned by Sable, has gotten approval to install safety valves on the pipeline. Without these valves, they would not be able to restart operations. When the county voted on whether to allow Sable to construct these shutoff valves in 2023, they arrived at a 2-2 stalemate, blocking further action by the oil company. Since then, Sable sued the Santa Barbara supervisors and the Santa Barbara Planning Commission. Eventually, the county folded to Sable under the condition that the lawsuit against them be dropped following the construction of the safety valves. With the restarting of the pipeline comes additional monitoring on behalf of Sable. The Pacific Pipeline Company will create a Santa Barbara County-based surveillance and response team, will provide Santa Barbara first responders with training to equip them to deal with emergencies, and will give the pipeline infrastructural improvements. Santa Barbara County, however, will not have jurisdiction over any of the changes made to the pipeline. This is due to the fact that the valves and equipment are entirely underground. When the Refugio oil spill occurred, the lawyer representing affected landowners described the pipelines as Swiss cheese. Now, Sable reports that in the case of a rupture, 41,889 barrels of oil, quote, could drain by gravity alone, end quote, out of the pipeline at its most delicate point. This massive amount of oil would be 14 times the amount that spilled into the ocean during the Refugio oil spill. To learn more about the significance of this decision, I spoke with Brady Bradshaw from the Center for Biological Diversity. First, can you just please introduce yourself?
Hey, my name is Brady Bradshaw. I am the senior oceans campaigner with the Center for Biological Diversity.
First of all, can we talk about the devastation that occurred during the 2015 Refugio oil spill?
Yes, if people were in, you know, in town, you'll know the devastation was terrible. Oil spills are so devastating to the marine wildlife. What happened was an onshore pipeline ruptured because of corrosion, and it spilled and actually drained into the ocean. And there were up to 450 million gallons of oil spilled, which is a massive amount of oil, and it impacted wildlife in the ocean, coated the wings of birds that became unable to fly and died, and it killed dolphins, marine mammals, seabirds, and just this oil sort of coats the entire shoreline, which is an incredibly important part of the ecosystem.
Is our area particularly environmentally sensitive to things like oil spills?
Well, the California coastline is a pretty diverse habitat. We have a rocky shoreline that has just a beautiful arrangement of wildlife. The Santa Barbara Channel is one of the most magnificent areas. There's kelp forests, and it's a migration route for many large mammals like blue whales pass through, which are just the largest mammal on Earth. So yeah, it's a really special place.
The pipeline is starting up again. How do you feel about that?
It's not a given that the pipeline will start up. The company is Sable, which is a small company that Exxon has tried to pass off their assets to, are trying to restart this pipeline by the end of 2026. And if they succeed, they get to run an oil operation. And if they don't succeed, Exxon has to take back all of their old decrepit infrastructure. So it's not a done deal. There are several agencies that have yet to approve different steps of the process.
So at what point could this effort to restart the pipeline fail?
The county has yet to approve this transfer of ownership between the two companies. The company has yet to get a certificate of financial, it's called a certificate of financial responsibility, and they have to get an approved oil spill response plan. And they submitted an oil spill response plan that estimated a worst case oil spill would be 0 barrels of oil. But they used their existing non-producing pipeline to make that estimate. So it's sort of tactics like that that make us concerned about the way that this company is trying to maneuver their way to a restart. But they haven't gotten approval to restart the pipeline from the state fire marshal, which is the agency responsible for giving them a restart permission. And they haven't been allowed to overtake an offshore pipeline lease that the State Lands Commission will consider a little bit later this year.
The PPC, in an effort to restart the pipeline, has said that it'll take a few steps in order to achieve that, including adding 16 safety valves to the pipeline, as well as creating and training response teams and repairing some infrastructure. Do you think that these steps are enough to prevent another disaster?
PPC, also known as Sable, you know that Sable owns PPC now because they were transferred from Exxon. You know, they have to say that they're going to operate this safely. That's the, you know, that's the right answer that they're supposed to say. But the bottom line is this pipeline ruptured 9 years ago from corrosion, and it's been sitting there for 9 more years corroding further. And so we're very concerned. The bottom line is, no matter how many valves you put in or how many safety workers you have walking the pipeline route, or that you say you have, it's not going to be a safe pipeline, because at the very basic level, it's corroded and old. And same goes for the offshore platforms that have been sitting offshore for many years beyond their intended lifespans. All of this infrastructure is incredibly dangerous.
While there are still steps until this pipeline can actually be active, the Santa Barbara County Board of Supervisors has taken steps to kind of pave the way for Sable to restart this pipeline. What does it signal to you that the county has sort of conceded to this oil company rather than attempted to transition to move away from oil, for example?
Well, first of all, there's a really interesting thing going on right now with this lawsuit that Sable brought against the county. So Sable sued the county for not approving their valve installation project. This is a big oil company. These are, you know, oil producers threatening a county with lawsuits. So the county, we haven't actually seen them affirmatively say that they are completely giving over their jurisdiction. But this was the result of a lawsuit settlement. And so this is just one step in the process. And the county actually still has some extra jurisdiction when it comes to whether or not they grant the transfer of ownership. So there are still several agencies in the way of Sable restarting this project.
Are there any steps that you at the Center for Biological Diversity and maybe other environmental organizations in the area are going to take or potentially will take to prevent the restarting of this pipeline?
Yeah, we're continuing to call on the state fire marshal, the office of the state fire marshal, for a public comment period and environmental review of the restart applications. The company has to get permission to operate a pipeline without effective corrosion prevention. And this is extremely concerning to us. So we're continuing to call on that state agency to have a public process. We're also continuing to call on the State Lands Commission not to give over the leases for the offshore pipeline to Sable, because we don't believe that Sable can safely and effectively operate that pipeline. And the State Lands Commission has the authority to say, sorry, Sable, you can't have this pipeline, you can't have the lease on it. So there are several agencies that we think can do the right thing and stop this whole project from restarting.
KCSB will continue to cover the Sable Oil Pipeline story as the company attempts to restart operations and environmental advocates scramble to stop them. With KCSB News, I'm Rosie Boltman.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.